All right. Decisions. Got to prepare. I'm never very good at preparing. You know that, Kiana? I'm just not that good at preparing. I always end up at the last minute running around. Oh, no. What the hell's going to happen? But it's not happening that way today because we are prepared. All right.
And this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate. We've got a great show for you today. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking to some of the artists responsible for a play I saw recently. Yes, sisters and brothers, live theater is back. The play is Octoroon, written by Brandon Jacob Jenkins. And although you won't be able to see this particular performance in Los Angeles, this is a work to look for. We'll be talking to actors Matthew Hancock and Rob Nagel, as well as the director Judith Moreland. So stick around for that. Don't miss it, all right? And opening the show up, we'll be talking about the latest developments in the international campaign to free Iran's political prisoners. This is something that's happening in the world, and too few people know about it and are trying to do something about it. I'll be talking with Larry Everest, who is a signatory of the Emergency Appeal to Free Iran's Political Prisoners and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda. And he's a contributor to RevCom.us Revolution newspaper. His latest piece, Vicious Wave of Repression Sparks Global Movement to Free Iran's Political Prisoners, is posted at Counterpunch. And a little later, we'll be joined by Bahrang, an Iranian-American activist who has been fighting to bring awareness and support for this life-or-death question, all right? So now let's talk with Larry Everest.
And Larry, I was just looking for a long way to get around to you. How you doing, man?
Pretty good, man. And I'm glad you did get around to me.
Come on. I know you'd chase me down if I didn't. Anyway, basically, there's so much going on when we look at what's happening in the world right now. There's so much going on. And I was just thinking about this the other day, where you're walking down the street. You can be walking down the street, and sometimes you feel that, like, that kind of sizzle where it makes you know that there's something electronic, there's something, whatever's going on, that just in your own thinking and in how people are carrying themselves. But there's also a lot of times when people don't necessarily get what's happening. And I think that's actually something that we have to really bust open with. Anybody who cares, who gives a damn about the world and people, needs to actually, you know, start to stand up and really fight to go up against all the stuff that this system has been bringing down on people. And I want to let people know, before I jump into this with Larry, is that Larry is a signatory to the Emergency Appeal, the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, and a contributor to Revolution, RevCom.us. And his latest piece is Vicious Wave of Repression Sparks Global Movement to Free Iran's Political Prisoners. And it's posted at Counterpunch. And I read it a couple of times, and I think everybody should get out there and read it. So welcome to the show, Larry.
Hey, thanks so much, Michael. I'm really glad to be with you today.
Yeah. So let's jump into this, all right? And we have some time to spread out. Basically, the first thing I wanted to ask you about is, you know, look, you're a lifelong revolutionary internationalist who reported from Iran for Revolution newspaper shortly after the 1979 revolution, and have covered it since then, and now you're involved in the international emergency campaign to free Iran's political prisoners. What prompted the campaign? What's it about?
Well, one thing that prompted this campaign is Narges Mohammadi. She's a former engineering professor, the vice president of the Human Rights Defenders in Iran, and a journalist. And she was imprisoned for over 6 years. For what? For running a human rights movement and campaigning for the abolition of the death penalty. And then, during her imprisonment, she was brutalized. She was sexually assaulted. She describes an incident in which a prison doctor was so violent toward her, even one of these hardened Islamic Republic interrogators was forced to leave the room. Yet she, like other political prisoners, is someone who continuously, courageously speaks out, even in the face of this repression. Now, she was released several months ago, but then suddenly in May, she was again sentenced to 2.5 years and 80 lashes. Think about that. 80 lashes as a form of punishment. And again, what was her crime this time? It was protesting. While she was in jail, She spoke out against the murder of protesters in Iran. There was a wave of mass protests against the government in November 2019. She spoke out against the killing of protesters. And just for that, she's sentenced to another 2.5 years in prison. And this past couple of weeks, she's been twice physically assaulted. She's outside prison waiting sentences. She said she's not going to abide by it. She's going to refuse to go back. And she was physically assaulted and now fears for her life. And this story, Narges's story, is being repeated hundreds, if not thousands, of times across Iran, where there's been a new and brutal wave of arbitrary arrests, of imprisonment, of torture, and execution that's hammering Iranians from all walks of life. We consider this is a real emergency. The lives and dignity of hundreds of these political prisoners are on the line. They're in imminent mortal danger. And this is especially heightened now that Ibrahim Raisi has become the new president. And Raisi was centrally involved in orchestrating the 1988 massacre of 4,000 to 5,000 political prisoners in Iran. So right now, as you were saying in your lead-in, this is a moment where everybody who stands for justice and yearns for a better world needs to rally to the cause of Iran's political prisoners. And we'll say more.
Hello?
Listeners to vote. Hello?
Yes, go ahead. You faded out for a minute.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wanted to urge all the listeners to go to our website, which is freeiranspoliticalprisonersnow.org, and sign the emergency appeal there. The lives of Iran's political prisoners hang in the balance. We must act now, which also opposes any U.S. aggression or sanctions, and help get this appeal out into the world before millions. This is an appeal that's been signed by over 2,200 people, including relatives of current prisoners, former Iranian political prisoners, prominent voices of conscience like Gloria Steinem, Nobel laureate in 1997, Jody Williams, renowned playwright and author Ariel Dorfman. And publishing this appeal will do a lot to expose this outrageous imprisonment and treatment of political prisoners and escalate the global condemnation of this that could lead to the freeing and will contribute to the freeing of these prisoners and to strengthening their and supporting them. So we need help getting this published. We have a plan to do it, and we encourage people to help.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a couple of other questions that you've touched on somewhat, but I'd like to get a little bit deeper into, too. You know, this whole point that you've been making about how this developed, where it came from, what's it doing, can you paint a little bit more of a picture of what this repression has been like across the, you know, Iran? I mean, it's really a very, very important thing for people to understand that this is not just sort of like people get up and they go to prison or they do their time and they get out and then they go home and all this other stuff. But there's an actual campaign that the regime has unleashed, and it's actually had real and very dangerous and deadly repercussions to people. You know, the roots and resistance of this whole thing. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, I think many of your listeners will know that the Islamic Republic of Iran has always been a brutal and extremely repressive theocracy, enforcing a medieval patriarchy on women, the forced veiling, forced to wear the hijab. It's exploiting workers, it's imprisoning dissidents, and so on. And I saw some of this brutal repression firsthand when I was in Iran in 1979 and 1980, when the Khomeini regime was consolidating its power, killing protesters. I was at one such protest. and so on. I was in the Kurdish areas, which were under military attack by the regime at that time for the Kurds daring to stand up for their national rights. So this has gone on for over 40 years, but recently this this repression has escalated dramatically, and it's done so because in 2017 and 2019, powerful and righteous uprisings of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, Iranians shook the whole country. In 2019, this involved over 90 cities and towns, with the protests often centered in the most impoverished areas. And the regime's response was live fire, with killing hundreds of people and imprisoning arresting between 6,000 and 8,000 in 2019. And so that took place in 2019. And then in the fall of 2020, when the anniversary of this November uprising was approaching, the regime unleashed another wave of mass arbitrary arrests, sweeping up artists, intellectuals, women's rights advocates, revolutionaries, minority nationalities and religious groups, filmmakers, and so on. And I just want to give you a few examples of the kinds of people that were swept up in it. One group was dual nationals. Nahid Taghavi's an Iranian-German citizen. Mehran Rouf is an Iranian-British citizen. Nahid, and you had her daughter, Miriam Claren, on your show, I know, a number of weeks ago. Nahid was arbitrarily arrested. She was held in solitary confinement for over 150 days. She was interrogated 80 different times for a total of 1,000 hours. I mean, all without legal counsel. And just stop and think about it. 1,000 hours of interrogation. And this is a 66-year-old former architect, women's rights advocate, who, you know, is suffering from diabetes and hypertension, wasn't even given medical care. And Mehran Rouf is a British-Iranian citizen, arbitrarily arrested. He's a labor activist. He's been held in solitary confinement for over 8 months, finally released the day before he was set to go to court on June 13th, just a couple of weeks ago. Another thing that's been happening is that Baha'is, which is the largest non-Muslim religious minority in Iran, there's some 300,000 Baha'i in Iran, are facing intensified persecution and assault. There's been a wave of executions of prisoners and political prisoners, over 50 in recent months, 250 in the year 2020. And as this has been going on, Iran has threatened to imprison filmmakers like Mohammad Razalouf, who has a new film, There Is No Evil. People can see this online. Is he and other filmmakers are threatened with prison. One, Mohammad Nourizad, is in prison and reported very near death. And world-famous human rights lawyer Nazreen Sotoudeh just spent her third year in prison. And she's being held at this prison called Garchak, a prison for women. And her husband wrote a very powerful article about this in Ms. Magazine, where he described going into the cells his wife's being held in as being transported to the Middle Ages, a dungeon of overcrowding, underfeeding, torture, and rape that inmates call the end of the world. And again, what was Nazreen arrested for and sentenced to 38 years in prison and 140 lashes? What was her so-called crime? Defending dissidents, children who were abused, and women who refused to wear the veil. So this is just utterly outrageous, and I really encourage your listeners to watch the film Nazreen. It's a very powerful movie. It's available on Hulu and other websites. And actually, the producers of the film, Jeff Kaufman and Marcia Ross, have endorsed our emergency appeal to free Iran's political prisoners. Just to sum it up, basically anyone who wants to criticize or challenge the regime has been imprisoned can end up in jail.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I was going to ask you about, it's because I know you've spoken to it a little bit, but I wanted to see if there's anything more you want to add to this, because it's not just, you know, it's very heavy when you're talking about all this, and people I think a lot of times people don't recognize what this all means. You know, this is horrifying and terrible, you know, situation that's in Iran, and the people are being, you know, just, I mean, people are being reduced to non-people, you know, and what happens to them is a non-event. You know, and you're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of people who have been disappeared, who have been tortured, who have been, you know, all kinds of things happened. And what I want to note now is, you know, and we're going to move on in a couple minutes, but I wanted to know now, you've started to talk about this, but let's talk a little bit more about what has the emergency campaign been doing? You have an emergency campaign that's recognized how horrible this is. What have people been doing around this? What have people around the world been doing to take it up, the issue of Iran's political prisoners?
Well, there is a global movement around this, and I'd encourage people to read my Counterpunch article that details this. But the emergency campaign was formed in solidarity with that movement, with relatives and supporters of the prisoners and the Burn the Cage movement, Burn the Cage, Free the Birds movement in Europe. And, you know, our goal is, as we say in the appeal, to free Iran's political prisoners by generating a global exposure and outrage. And we think that it's very, very important for people in this country, which has intervened so militantly and so in such a deadly way in the affairs of Iran for decades and decades and decades, caused so much suffering there. It's very urgent for those of us in this belly of the beast to stand up now at this moment when the U.S. and the Iranian government, two reactionary outmoded forces, are in collision. And we feel very strongly, and our appeal spells this out, that while the governments of the U.S. and Iran act from their national interests, we, the people in the U.S. and Iran, and the people of the world, need to act in our interests as part of getting to a better world. And a key part of that is to unite to defend the political prisoners of Iran, which, of course, if they can do this to the political prisoners, it's a form of terrorizing and threatening Iran's 80 million people. Trying to prevent them from rising up. And we say in the appeal that in the U.S. we have a special responsibility to both speak out against this vile repression by the Islamic Republic and to actively oppose any war moves by the U.S. government that would or sanctions, which are very onerous on Iran right now, that are bringing unbearable suffering to the people there. So I think this is very important. And one thing I just want to mention here, some of us, you know, the campaign is basically made up of anyone who wants to free Iran's political prisoners and agrees with what we say in the appeal. As a revolutionary, I understand that this issue of the clash between Islamic fundamentalism is a much broader global issue, and I want to refer people and encourage people to study an analysis that Bob Avakian did on this, the revolutionary leader Bob Avakian did, in which he points out that what's involved in this clash is really a clash between outmoded reactionary forces, one in the oppressed countries like Iran, the other from the imperialist world, in other words, countries like the U.S. And he goes on to make the very important point that these two reactionary poles reinforce each other even while opposing each other, and that if you side with either of these outmoded, you end up strengthening both. And of course, he goes on to say that in terms of the danger to humanity and its future, imperialism is by far the greater problem. But I think this is we've been running up against this issue and taking out the campaign, and I think this, what is said in our appeal, as well as for a deeper analysis of the broader phenomenon, this analysis that Bob Avakian has done at revcom.us is very crucial now. In other words, it isn't a question of, well, I need to, I think the U.S. is the lesser evil, so I'm going to support what they're doing, or you think the Islamic Republic is the lesser problem, so you're going to let them slide and not criticize them. No, both of these are reactionary forces, and supporting or even tacitly supporting either one strengthens both. We need a different way. And in particular on the campaign, I think the key thing right now that we are working on doing is publishing this appeal. And there's a lot of, we're running ads in The Nation and Ms. Magazine, and we're working to publish this even more broadly throughout society. So I think the thing for people to do is go to our website, freeiranspoliticalprisonersnow.org. You can also find us on Twitter at Iran Prison Emerge, EMERG, at Iran Prison Emerge, or you can follow or go to my Twitter feed at Larry Everest, and you'll connect with the campaign. And we know that this work is giving heart to the political prisoners. We know that. It's very important. And freeing them could crack open a door for all of Iran's hundreds and hundreds of political prisoners, and for Iran's 80-plus million people to continue their struggle for a better society and world. So encourage your listeners to join us in this effort.
Mm-hmm. All right, Larry, I want to thank you for joining us today, and we're going to continue on. I want to actually have, you mentioned earlier that we have somebody else who's eager to speak around this, and his name is Behrang, and he's an Iranian-American, and he's an activist in the Bay Area, and he's been actually throwing in on this. So, you know, because there is, I mean, look, it's important. Everything that you were saying, I kept thinking about, okay, this is important. It needs to be done. And it's not just, it's not just sort of a one over going, falling, jumping over backs. It's actually, there is a response to all the attacks that's needed. And that requires getting people who have to do this, who are eager to do this. Behrang, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. Nice to hear your voice, man.
Yeah.
Jump right into this. I wanted to introduce you to people now, and by reading an excerpt of the statement by renowned Argentinian, Chilean American novelist, playwright, and human rights activist Ariel Dorfman. So why don't I just read that right now, and then we'll jump into what you have to say. Okay.
Sure.
Okay. News from the global movement, Ariel Dorfman, we should not let them down. If I have signed on to the emergency campaign to free political prisoners in Iran, it is because I know that this initiative will effectively call attention to the situation of men and women in that country who, if enough pressure is brought to bear on its leaders, could tomorrow be liberated from terrible conditions and extraordinary injustice. And even if those leaders do not listen, I am convinced from personal experience that the prisoners themselves are given strength to survive and persevere. They are listening. They know others far away care what happens to them, and we should not let them down. So with that as a backdrop, let's jump into this, Bayrang. Go ahead.
That puts it so beautifully, and Larry's talk earlier was very to the point. Before I start, I just want to point out that we're not advocating any sort of military intervention in Iran by U.S. We're against war. We're against any sort of invasion, or we're for talks. We want these talks to go on, but we want the talks to focus on human rights. We want them to focus on ethnic and minority rights, both religious minorities, ethnic minorities, LGBTQ rights, which are violated every day in Iran, women rights. And these all should be considered in the talks with Iranian government, and these agendas should be pushed because people of Iran, they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. It's on one side there's a undemocratic theocracy, and on the other side are these crushing Western sanctions that are making life pretty difficult for people, and especially for prisoners that come from every walk of life. I mean, the funny and the sad thing is you can find any sort of prisoner that his or her rights has been violated in Iran. We have, labor activists, we have monarchists, we have students, we have just regular people that did not want to follow certain religious rules. There, we have people within the ex-officials that, they change their mind or they think differently than the current ones that are in prison. All innocents. We have foreign, Iranian dual citizens that are in prison and are being used as pawns in negotiations. And we want people to pay attention to these. Go to the website that Larry mentioned, Free Iran Prisoners. Now I think let me look at my list. It's a long name, but Free Iran's Political Prisoners Now.org. And in there, if you can donate, please donate. If you can't donate, just sign the petition, because one thing that we know from recently freed high-profile prisoners like Mazyar Bahari, like Jason Rezaian, is that when the prison officials and when Iranian officials know that a prisoner's name is mentioned, the outside media is talking about it, the Western media, the audience, the people are talking about them, they treat them better in prisons. They get better food, they get more visitations, there's a little bit less abuse. So the minimum thing that we can do here is just to bring these people's names up, let the society know who they are, why they're there for no reason, and that way maybe we can help them. I just wanted to tell you guys the hardships of living in Iran these days. In 2019, as Larry mentioned, there was an uprising. And I myself was actually involved in 2009 uprising, the Green Movement. And the difference between the one in 2009 versus the one in 2019 was that in 2009, it was mostly middle class, upper middle class, and wealthier segment of the society that was fighting for freedom of speech, freedom of free election, and things like this. In 2019, it was the working class people who came to free it because the gasoline prices has tripled. The official inflation rate is 40%. The Iranian money has devalued by about 70%. So these people were, you know, they were hungry. They were asking for rice, but also asking for food, basic necessities that were not being met. Imagine in U.S. if the gas prices become $12 a gallon. You know, well, how would people react? Their livelihood will be destroyed. So these people came in the streets. They demand some basic necessities from the government. And the government response was much heavier, much more deadly than 2009. I think in 2009, when we were protesting and supporting the protesters, the total death, which is still terrible, but the total numbers was about 120 to 130 people died. In this one, in 2019, over 1,500 people were killed. Over 1,500, maybe more. We don't know. But because the government just, you know, they came and started shooting with live ammunition. In some places, there were reports that they brought in war equipment for war in a protest and shot at people. So from my own personal experience, I have a relative that's wealthy and she's well off, that lives in Iran. And she, you know, her personally, she's doing okay. But what she does on the side is she takes care of stray dogs. She has 5 stray dogs that she adopted, and she takes care of them. And she has a deal with a local butcher. And she goes to the butcher shop and collects, like, chicken bones and skin and chicken feet to feed it. And she brings it home, cooks it, and feeds it to the dog. She can't find those things anymore because the butcher has told her regular people are buying them and eating them because they can't afford to buy real chicken because of the sanctions and because of limitations and because their money has devalued so much. Mm-hmm. So it's a terrible situation. And I don't want to keep repeating myself. I want people to go to the website, go to freeiranpoliticalprisonersnow.org and just support this movement.
All right. Thank you very much. And Larry, you have any finishing comments you want to make?
Oh, I'll leave it right where Behrang did. Go to the website or on social media at Larry Everest or at Iran Prison Emerge, EMERG, and sign the appeal and support the campaign.
All right. Larry, thank you very much. And
thank you, Michael.
Sure. And we'll be talking to both of you guys sometime soon in the future, I hope. So,
all right, thank you, Michael.
All right, thank you. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. That's right. Given the way the world is today, you really got to stand. You need to stand. Humanity demands that you stand. And stand in the right direction, too. All right? All right? None of that other stuff. All right?
Right now, we're going to play a piece by Bob Avakian. Why is police terror necessary for this system? This is a contribution to all the talk about critical race theory. Critical race theory is an academic framework that the oppression of black people and other people of color is not just a question of individual racism or prejudice, but it is embedded in legal systems and policies. It looks at institutionalized racism, systematic racism. Now, I don't think that these Nazis, Trump, Ted Cruz, or little Hitler Josh Hawley, actually know what it is, but they are attacking it, and several states are moving to implement a full-on Fascist America First educational system in response. So let's hear Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, give a scientific answer to all this, that police terror is not just embedded in U.S. institutions, but is fundamental to the capitalist system in the U.S.
Why is this terror and murder necessary for this system in order to ensure its order and its ongoing functioning? The answer is that from the beginning of this country, white supremacy has been poured into the foundation and built into the institutions and the ongoing functioning of this system. Specifically with regard to black people, the centuries of oppression they have suffered, from slavery days to the days of Jim Crow segregation and Ku Klux Klan terror, to the present time, with the continuing systematic discrimination against black people in every part of society, employment, housing, education, health care, and on, all this has resulted in a situation where masses of black people today, and in particular youth, have been robbed of a means for a decent life, with many maintained in conditions of desperate poverty and deprivation. This, again, is not simply because those who are in the seats of power and deciding government policy are racist, though that is true of most of them. It is fundamentally because of the nature of the system itself and the historically evolved requirements and dynamics of this system of capitalism imperialism. Now that is a big mouthful. The nature of the system itself and the historically evolved requirements and dynamics of this system of capitalism imperialism. So let's break it down. This country was founded on the enslavement of masses of African people, as well as the genocidal subjugation of Native Americans and theft of their land. And its further development involved the conquest of huge parts of Mexico, reducing people of Mexican origin to second-class status as well. This required the propagation of racism to justify all the horrific oppression. Then, when the Civil War broke out over the question of slavery, and even when slavery was abolished as a result of that Civil War, given that white supremacy had been and remained such a crucial part of the glue holding the country together, the only way to put it back together on the foundation of the capitalist system was to once again forcefully assert white supremacy. That is why, very soon after the end of the Civil War, black people were subjected to the system of Jim Crow segregation, backed up by systematic terror, punctuated by repeated lynchings, while the genocidal aggression against and theft of the land of Native Americans was stepped up, and immigrants from Mexico were subjected to ongoing discrimination and violence by the enforcers of this system.
That was Bob Avakian on Why is Police Terror Necessary for This System? You can find the video and more on the YouTube channel, The RevComs.
And you need to get hold of the work that he does. It's really, really important for people to have a steady hand on that and understanding of what's going on, because the hellified condition that the world is in right now and the fact that this monster here is responsible for so much of that means it's necessary for you to check out everything. And I think especially things like what Bob Avakian is talking about, a way to change the entire setup, all right? And he's a revolutionary. It's don't shut your eyes and ears to what's going on and what's happening right now on both sides, all right? All right, right now, I'm very happy to, and I know I wanted to have a little bit more time, but we're going to push through this. I want to talk to some folks that have been involved in a play that I went to see the other night that just knocked my socks off. And it did knock my socks off. And Kiana, you know that, because I walked in and I had painted my socks onto my feet because I had no longer had socks. I just lost it, you know? But it was an incredibly important, incredibly moving, play that actually really jabbed at you, okay? And we are now going to talk to some of the people that were involved in this, Matthew Hancock, who was playing, I don't know whether to say this or not, but it's BJJ, I'm not sure, George McCluskey, and he was up in there, and Rob Nagel, and I think I've had both of you folks on the show before. I want to welcome you back. And then we have also we're lucky enough to have the person who was actually helping to control all this and make it real is Judith Moreland. So Judith, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
Yeah. And everybody else, welcome to the show.
Good to hear you.
Hello.
Thanks
Hi.
For having us back.
Good morning.
Yeah. Good morning. why don't we jump into this right away? I mean, what is it that, you know, when I went down to see this and it was sort of, it really struck me, the way that things are happening, the way that things are going, it's really very, very, it's problematic for anybody with a conscience, for anybody with a heart, for anybody who cares about people, who cares about the future. And yet, as we do this, you know, so few people at the moment are willing to stand up and do something around this. And I thought that what you folks did with this play was remarkable. And I think it really did. I know when I was leaving, I heard a lot of people standing around talking about it. My wife and I were talking about it all the way home. It's something that actually really pulled at people. And I think it'd be important to talk about that. So basically, I don't know who wants to start here. maybe you can have Judith. We can have you start and then we'll go on from there. Okay.
Okay. Well, I guess it's probably best to talk about what the play is. It's a play called An Octoroon, and it's by this brilliant playwright named Brandon Jacobs Jenkins. And it premiered in New York in 2014 and won an Obie the following year. And I think a year after that, the playwright was named MacArthur Genius based on this work and other works. I saw the original play in 2015, and I absolutely agree. It knocked my socks off, too. I had never had an experience in the theater like it. And what this play is a play within a play. It's also a meditation of American culture and American history. Matthew Hancock, who plays BJJ, one of three roles he plays. Rob Nagel also plays three roles in the play. BJJ comes out at the beginning of the play and talks directly to the audience, tells us that he's been a little depressed, and so his therapist recommends that he does an adaptation of a play that's kind of been obsessing him, which is a 19th century melodrama called The Octoroon, which was written by the Neil Simon of the day. This guy, Dion Boucicault, who wrote this play, was just about as famous as he is to us. So BJJ tries to do an adaptation of the play. Unfortunately, the play is set on a plantation before the Civil War, and all the white actors who are playing the racist characters all quit. So his therapist suggests that he play the white characters. So we see Matthew put on whiteface and take on both the hero and the villain of this melodrama. In the meantime, Rob Nagel, as Dion Boucicault, comes on stage, listens to Matthew talking about how hard it is to get a production done, and then Rob talks directly to the audience about how it sucks that he's not famous anymore when he was the Neil Simon of his day. But Rob then puts on red face, as Dion Boucicault did in the 19th century, to play the indigenous character in the play within the play. And at the same time, we also see a South Asian, a Filipina American actress, come on, and she puts on blackface to play the highly offensive racial stereotypes that were written in the original 19th century play, because of course black people, we weren't allowed to actually play ourselves. It was always white people in blackface. And so then we are thrown into this 19th century melodrama where we see people in blackface, whiteface, and redface, as well as African-American actors and white actors, take on this melodrama. But then the fourth wall is broken all the time, and we go back and forth between what's happening right now and what's happening in the play. So it's a satire. It's very funny until it's not.
Yeah.
And that's really the point.
That's exactly the point. Yeah. I know. That's the best way to put it. Now, who do we actually have available right now? Oh, Matthew. Okay, Matthew. We're having a little trouble with our. Yeah, we're having a little trouble with our system here. But Matthew, let's talk to you about this. You know, you played. Okay. Now, it's interesting because you played the role that you played, and I thought that, you know, just what we were just talking about, what Judith was just talking about. But when you were doing this, and both you and Rob, the way this happened, I mean, this whole idea of the way you transformed but didn't, the way you transformed but didn't transform really became deeper and deeper. And people actually have to sit back. And I think it's important that in relation to this play, people have to sit back and deal with a very real, complex, but also not so complex that people shouldn't know about it or understand it. But the whole way that the treatment of black people exists in this country. What's happening? You know, it never fails to just really get me, you know, my blood boiling when people act like, well, I didn't do it, or I don't, you know, whatever. And you know, it's just that you're looking at the system and the way it is. And I thought that one of the things that happened here with this, particularly what Octoroon does, is it does actually put the people who are living in it in front of us. And I thought that would be really important to talk about. So go ahead.
Yeah, I think the piece really does hold a mirror up to the past, and in that past, you know, comparing where we are today. And as we can see, we're not that too far along. I think a lot of systems have transformed, you know, but the root of white supremacy and what that is and how that permeates within things is always very, very present. And I think this play really highlights, you know, the juxtaposition of that. And then also to, you know, how people of color have been represented in the media, in the zeitgeist. And so it's a meditation on all that, like Judy said. And, you know, someone had asked what, you know, why this play? And I was like, well, you know, in an age where, you know, critical race theory is being questioned, and we have people who are actively trying to rewrite history. I think that that makes this play that much more needed today and right now.
Mm-hmm. Rob, are you available?
I am here. Yeah.
Okay. Good. You know, I spent a lot of time looking at you when I was watching that because I kept thinking these other folks have really dignified things going on. And you did, but it was just this. Sometimes it was just a sneaking in and floating across, and then making your comments. And I thought it was just done very well because it did say something about the whole way that things are being pushed around these days. So why don't we talk about what your thoughts are on this?
It's a mad ride, is what this play is to me. It's one of the most physically and emotionally demanding things I've done in a while. And that's easy for me to say because Matthew has so much more to do physically and emotionally demanding work. But it makes me uncomfortable. I know it makes the audiences uncomfortable. They don't like to sit in their discomfort, so they like to dismiss what they're seeing. But the meditation that it's causing folks to go through as they're watching this disturbing and hilarious show could not be more timely as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I know they were going to do it last year before a little, you know, before Miss Rona arrived and changed our lives for a bit. So I'm glad that it's coming out of the time that we've lived through in the last 15 months. But it's a crazy ride, and there are no punches that are pulled in what Brandon Jacobs Jenkins has written, nor in, I think, what Judith has encouraged us to go through each night. I talk about it as a mad ride, and I'm just so grateful to be on it with everybody in this cast and with this crew.
Mm-hmm. Now, one question I'd ask, and we can go back and follow everybody else with it, but this whole point about racial classifications and how they might seem to be at the heart of the play today, but then, as it says, first lines of the play say, "I'm a black playwright. I don't know exactly what that means, but here I am to tell a story." And I thought that was actually pretty heavy because there are so many stories. There are so many stories that people, that black people who are just, you know, who are out doing work, who are, you know, sitting in their living room, who are doing whatever, they are people who have stories that need to be heard. And I thought that's one of the things that this play did do, is it really brings that to the fore, that people need to know this stuff, that people need to be able to grasp it and understand what the meaning of it is. So I don't know exactly who to ask about this. Matthew, I would admit, why don't I start with you? Because I, you know, just the way, and I've seen you before in other shows, and just the way that you carried this, and it's was really, you know, there was so much there in terms of the, you know, the basically the changes that you went through and how you became, you know, a different character in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get to play, you know, BJJ, who like you said, black playwright, who was essentially, you know, starting off the story. But then I also get to play George within the melodrama. I get to play George, the hero, and McCloskey, the villain. It's a very interesting track in this show, the shifts are very fun. But it's the type of, you know, as an actor, it's the type of challenge that you look for. But also, too, the parts are actually really juicy parts. And it's very interesting the perspective that each character has in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, let me ask, you know, I keep looking at these things and I'm thinking, damn, we've got so much to say, so much to dig into. So let me see. Judith, why don't I ask you this? This is something that I think is important, and too many people don't get the chance to actually roll around in this, that this is a play about race in America, and it's when is a play about race in America not timely? You know, and I think that this is something that's really important that people understand this. And you know, this whole thing about the pursuit of all this other stuff that, you know, you can't do to race, you know, you can't just dismiss the racism that's here and what it's meant for people's lives. So, you know, I wanted to, you know, check maybe with you on that, and then we'll go across and see if other people have some comments on it, all right?
Yeah, I think you're right, and that's exactly what this play is talking about now. So it's so interesting that the country, or at least part of the country, is pushing back on the idea of exploring our American history through the prism of America's original sin, which is slavery. And actually, let's, you know, talk about the elephant in the room, and that's exactly what this play is about. And so I was kind of hoping that since we were talking about doing the play before Ms. Rona came to visit us, as Ron said, and George Floyd was murdered, one would hope that this play would no longer be timely, but it turns out that the play is more timely than ever because people are pushing back on the idea of critical race theory and institutionalized racism. But when you watch this play, although Brandon wrote this 7 years before the country started talking about it, this play is absolutely about how our culture is so defined and shaped by the labels that we have put on people that we don't even realize it until you see a black man putting on white face and then playing two white, quote-unquote, roles so perfectly. I'm always shocked when I watch this play when Matthew first comes out in white face, and one of his first lines is that he talks to a black character and he calls him the N-word. And it's so shocking to see a black man call another black man a pejorative, because this was not an inclusionary way of him using the word, that it's shocking. Mm-hmm. And then the casualness of the racism in a play that ostensibly was written as an abolitionist play. And that's the irony of the original play that Boucicault wrote. At the time, he was considered very leftist in saying that labels, because an octoroon, of course, is a person who is one-eighth black, so by and large, you cannot tell. I mean, that's such a minute amount that the person could pass and look white, but in Louisiana at the time, that was enough to be considered black. So
yeah, exactly.
Boucicault wrote this play as an abolitionist play, and so he was advanced at the time. But now, looking at the play now, we can see that he has such offensive stereotypes in the indigenous character in the play, mm-hmm. with the African-American characters. And Brandon Jacobs Jenkins rightfully highlights that by actually us watching people of different ethnicities play these different ethnicities, that you're shocked now, right. As Matthew said, that we actually haven't come that far, but yet we have come a long way. So right. The play kind of asks you, how far have we come? What's okay to laugh at now until we realize, oh, my goodness, right. We actually haven't traveled that far.
All right, Judith, I'm going to have to ask Rob if he has anything he can say within a minute, and I'm sorry, but we're just running out of time.
The theater is back in Los Angeles. I think we're the first to be doing anything. We're out under the stars in a parking lot in East Hollywood, combating with the lowriders and the LAPD and the news choppers. But we've got a brilliant play going on out there. It's one I would not want to miss if I were an audience member. And I encourage you, come and sit with us in the discomfort mm-hmm. of this conversation, because it's a spectacular one to be had right now.
Absolutely. And I want to thank everybody who was, all you guys that were there, you three folks there, thank you very much for helping out with this, for making this happen, all right, in relation to that.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure. You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
You're welcome.
Now, we have some time left, and with the 4th of July coming up, I thought it would be good to go out with another short quotation from Bob Avakian, B.A. If you can conceive of a world without America, without everything America stands for and everything it does in the world, then you've already taken great strides and begun to get at least a glimpse of a whole new world. If you can envision a world without any imperialism, exploitation, oppression, and the whole philosophy that rationalizes it, a world without division into classes or even different nations, and all of the narrow-minded, selfish, outmoded ideas that uphold this. If you can envision all this, then you have the basis for proletarian internationalism. And once you have raised your sights to all this, how could you not feel compelled to take an active part in the world historic struggle to realize it? Why would you want to lower your sights to anything less? That's Bob Avakian from his book, Basics.
All right, and right now I want to thank my guests, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, Kiana Brilliant on the board as usual. You just can't stop her. The board is just like smoke when she's in here, all right? And each and every one of you for being here, and I'll talk to you again next week because this is what I love doing.